Hello, how is everyone? My name is Christine Mastrangelo. I am a board member of the Boston Book Festival, and I trust you all had an awesome day, this being one of the last sessions. Thank you. We are super excited to be celebrating our 11th year and expanding our programming out to Roxbury, which you can continue to enjoy tomorrow. Since the beginning, our mission has been to celebrate the written word and to bring our community together. I love books because reading helps me to connect to a world that feels very complicated, but is also very beautiful. And I love the festival because I learn something new and exciting that is completely outside of the realm of my thinking. So if you share in our mission, or you enjoyed even just a part of the day, I would just encourage you to please donate whatever you can, because we are a nonprofit and we rely on donors like you. So please welcome our moderator, Hilary Shute, whose work in writing explores the comic as an artistic medium and reflection of our culture and collective consciousness. Her book, Why Comics, will also be available for her to sign in the room next door. Thank you so much.
All right. Hi, can everybody hear me? Yes. Okay, so I'm going to very quickly introduce our esteemed panelists, and then each of them will be giving a short presentation, which is really exciting. So I guess I should start with you.
It's up to you. I don't know what right to left or left to right or whatever. So.
Introduce you.
Yes.
So I'm doing off-the-cuff bios for some people.
Uh-oh.
Or I could read what you have in
no,
the book.
No, don't do that. That's okay.
Okay. So
just make it up.
I'll make it up.
Okay.
So Chris Ware is one of my most favorite cartoonists. He is the creator of many deeply significant graphic novels, including Jimmy Corrigan, Building Stories, and just out this month from Pantheon, Rusty Brown. So I'm thrilled that he's here. Andrew Blauner has a handy bio right here in the flap of my book. So I can tell you that Andrew Blauner is the founder of Blauner Books Literary Agency. And he's well known as an anthologist of very interesting topics. So his other anthologies include Central Park, Our Boston, and For the Love of Baseball, and something that is close to my heart, which is In Their Lives, Great Writers on Great Beatles Songs. Clifford Thompson is a writer and poet, and I'm reading from the book here, whose book Love for Sale and Other Essays received a Whiting Writers Award for Nonfiction in 2013. And he's also the author of the memoir Twin of Blackness, the novel Signifying Nothing, and the forthcoming What It Is, Race, Family, and One Thinking Black Man's Blues. He has taught creative nonfiction at the Bennington Writing Seminars, New York University, Columbia University, Queens College, and Sarah Lawrence. Chip Kidd is going to be one of my off-the-cuff bios since I know him. So Chip Kidd is one of the most significant graphic designers of our time and is a deeply famous book designer working for Penguin Random House. And in addition to designing countless amazing and famous book covers, he is the person who is responsible for the, or supervises, he's the editor at large for the graphic novel imprint at Pantheon. And he's the author of many books, including the amazing novel Cheese Monkeys about art school, and several works related to Batman.
As well as Only What's Necessary, which is a fantastic book. Most recent book he's done about Charles Schulz and Peanuts, which I would highly recommend to everybody here. And that's not, I'm not getting any money for that. It's just a really great book.
And so. I should say that Chip is on our panel today, and this is what I was going to come in with, because he designed this lovely cover for this Library of America volume. So we're going to start off with him telling us about that process.
All right. Well, as you've heard, I'm a famous book cover designer.
It's true. It's true.
It's like being
it's
a
objectively
famous
true.
Plumber. But thank you. So I sort of have a bit of history with making Peanuts books. And so I've done two of them myself, and one of my great regrets in life, I don't have many, is that I never made an effort to try and meet Mr. Schultz, which I then later learned was actually not that hard to do. but if you would fly to Santa Rosa and hang out in the warm puppy cafe. But anyway, my last book on Peanuts, as Chris mentioned, was called Only What's Necessary, which was kind of the title of which sort of encapsulated, I thought, Schultz's approach to cartooning, which I likened to the Bauhaus and reducing something to the very just basic elements and essences of what makes it. Like, and he stripped down what a comic strip looked like into what we now call minimalism, but it's more than that, and we'll talk about it. But for the cover of Only What's Necessary, I was trying to think, I want to use an image of Charlie Brown, but which one should I use? And this is his personal stationery. And I was allowed to go through all the archives at the Schultz Museum in Santa Rosa, California. And I worked very closely with Schultz's widow, Jeannie, and his assistant, Paige Braddock. And so I thought, well, this is what he thought, this was his personal stationery, so why don't I try and zoom in on Charlie Brown here to see how far I can go. And, you know, this is just the essence of his genius, is that even with just this much, you completely get it. Yeah. Just those little squiggles are an entire life, an entire inner life. And so I was then, the publisher of this book is Abrams, which does these big, beautiful coffee table art books, which this is going to be. And then my job was to convince them that this actually should just be the cover without anything else on it. And just as an experiment, I thought, what if I go even further? and now it's going too far. It looks like Morse code. But yes, you know, we got everybody to agree, and that's the way the book is in the world. And because I figured, if you're gonna get it online, you're gonna see it this way. Right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there's your title. And you don't need it on the front because that's only what's necessary. So anyway, I have the publisher of Peanuts Papers is Library of America. I had a very nice sort of freelance working relationship with them, and they asked me to work on the cover of this. And so what I did was I asked the page in the Schultz office to just send me images of the characters reading. And these were my first sort of attempts at this. And this one actually was my favorite. then it was determined that we want an image of Snoopy at the typewriter. And I had, this is a poster that I did for a show in Japan of original Peanut strips. And so I was going to use this art. This is art that Schultz himself had hand-colored. And they sent this for approval, and they said, well, actually, we like it, but that art belongs to the museum, and there was some complication with using it, but they said, we can send you black and white art, like me, and then you can color it yourself. So I took out magic markers and did that. And there it is. So, there you go.
All right. Oh, thank you. Yeah. So we're going down the line.
Yep, we're going to hear from you next.
Okay. Go last. Is that okay?
Okay. Is this working? Is this mic?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I thought I would just read the first, just the first part of the essay that I have in the book here, and then read something that I actually wrote yesterday, and it comes to about 3 minutes. Okay. So this essay is called "On Unhappiness, Friendship, and Charlie Brown," and it begins this way. During the cold months of the 1971-72 school year, when I was in third grade, my father brought home a cat that one of his buddies didn't want or couldn't keep. My family was soon to make the connection between animal hair, particularly cat hair, and my periodic bouts of asthma. But that hadn't happened yet, which is why, on the day I am recalling, I was home from school, propped up in my parents' bed and struggling for breath. For part of the day, I was alone with my grandmother, who was 77 or 78, and could hear you only if you stood next to her ear and spoke as if to someone a block away. At one point, while she was doing laundry or something in the basement, my breathing went from bad to worse. My lungs, which already felt as if they had shrunk to the size of thimbles, seemed to be shutting down altogether. I shouted for my grandmother, but she couldn't hear me. Then my parents walked in, took one look at me, and whisked me off to the hospital. I came home that evening, my breathing restored, I never saw the cat again, and returned to my parents' bed. Beside me was a stack of my older brother's Peanuts books, collections of comic strips from years past. I was comfortable after a day of misery. There was no place I had to go, and my favorite items in all the world were next to me. It was the happiest moment of my childhood. It's the truth. Okay, and I thought I would just read something that I wrote that... just some thoughts about the topic. So, okay, this is not in the book. Adam Gopnik writes in Good Griefs, his contribution to the Peanuts papers, Charlie Brown is in many ways a Holden Caulfield 6 or 7 years before he runs away from school. End quote. My twin reactions to this passage were, yes, somebody agrees with me about that, and darn, somebody else thought of that. In either case, I agree with Gopnik's statement, and perhaps I can add a little to it. The line I would draw begins with Charlie Brown and extends through Holden Caulfield and onto two figures I discovered in movies shown on TV in the early 1980s. The first was Benjamin Braddock, Dustin Hoffman's character in the 1967 film The Graduate. The second was Alvy Singer, Woody Allen's character, a stand-in for Woody himself, of course, and Annie Hall from 1977. Charlie Brown and Holden Caulfield were both products of the early 1950s. Peanuts debuted in 1950, The Catcher in the Rye the following year. Nothing is ever as certain as we make it out to be, and the 1950s, while often painted as a decade of smiling conformity, saw, like every era, its share of angst and rebellion and dread. It was, after all, the heyday of the Beats. And it is neither accident nor aberration that the decade that saw the American swagger in full flower, and particularly the American male swagger, also gave birth to Charlie Brown and Holden Caulfield, representations of male uncertainty, even if, as Chuck Klosterman points out, Charlie Brown's uncertainty sprang forth fully beginning in the late 1950s. Charlie and Holden are the undercurrents of all that American male know-how. That undercurrent had a brief period of cultural dominance 20 years later in the area of the, quote, sensitive male. That character was prefigured in The Graduate and perhaps reached its peak with Annie Hall. Think of Alvy Singer, too afraid to pick up the lobsters from the kitchen floor, begging a laughing Annie Hall to do it instead. A mere 3 years later, of course, came the election of Ronald Reagan at the beginning of a decade that also was to give us Rambo, and the sensitive male was done, taking its place on the shelf along the washboard and the butter churn. But he had left his mark, at least on the person talking to you now. Peanuts, The Catcher in the Rye, The Graduate, and Annie Hall, as much as anything else, were the works that made me want to be a writer, to capture a bit of my own male uncertainty on the page. And it all began with Charlie Brown.
All right.
So, first of all, thank you all for coming, and I thank my colleagues and friends here, and also everyone at the book festival. I have two different jobs. One is as a literary agent representing writers and their books, and separately, I edit and assemble these books on topics that are near and dear to me. And the first one that I brought to this festival was after the marathon bombings. And even though I am admittedly born and bred in New York, I am a New Englander at heart and in soul. And Hillary mentioned a couple of the other books, The Beatles, Coaches, Central Park. Each time I think that there isn't going to be another subject that's going to compel me enough to compile these books and all that goes into them. But a couple of years ago, I thought back, and this is to Chip's point about how difficult or not difficult it was to actually meet Schultz. And the fact that you didn't, and that I don't think David Michaelis did, and he wrote the definitive biography of Charles Schultz. So I was going to use my time to read from the preface of the book or to read a very beautiful statement that Barack Obama made about peanuts, but that's available online. I strongly encourage you to look up what President Obama wrote about peanuts, and it was part of the introduction for a Fantagraphics book. But the so-called origin story here for me is 1996, and a client named Bob Blauner, strangely no relation, was putting together his own anthology for a book called Our Mother's Spirits. And it was a collection of essays of men writing about the death of their mothers and the impact on their lives. And the preface for all this is that, of course, I loved peanuts growing up as a kid. So around that time, I saw an interview with Charles Schulz on, I think it was A&E Biography. And at the moment in the interview when he got to talking about his mother, he was very stoic, as most people know. But he got quite emotional when he talked about his mother. And if you know his biography at all, you know what a traumatic and influential relationship that was. So the long and short of it was, I was trying to help Bob, my client, put together this book, and I thought, I'll write a letter to Santa Rosa, to Sparky Schulz, and I thought, this is before email, it was 1996, at least before email for me, and I thought at best I'll get sort of a nice form letter back, but I'll have done the outreach. And the upshot of it was, sure enough, I was living on 86th Street in Manhattan, and I get a letter, a personal letter from Schulz, politely declining the invitation to contribute to the book, but saying, if you ever find yourself in Santa Rosa, please stop by, I'd love to say hello or meet you. And I thought, sir, if you're bluffing, I'm calling you on this, because by the next day I was calling my girlfriend, who happened to be a little redheaded girl at the time, and said, how would you feel about planning a little trip to Napa Valley, which is not far. And it took a while to organize, and yet there I was in his office, and he couldn't have been kinder, couldn't have been gentler. And this book, in some way, is my love letter to him and to Peanuts, and I'm grateful to all of the contributors who are here.
Oh, that's nice. All right, we'll applaud you. Yeah. That's really nice. So I brought some pictures because when I heard they wanted us to read 3 minutes worth of our essays, I didn't want to do that to you because you can tell from my voice that I have this amazing ability to communicate a sense of just like that you just don't want to listen to me talk or at least read out loud. So I brought some pictures just in case you don't know that much necessarily about Schulz's biography. This is actually Schulz's father, Carl Schulz, in his barber shop in St. Paul, Minnesota, sometime I believe in the 20s. That's him standing up there. And he was sort of the model for Schulz's entrepreneurial spirit and Schulz's wanting to be not only liked, but to be a generous person and to do his job the very best that he could. And this is the same barbershop that Schulz returned to in 1945, I believe, after serving as a light machine gun sergeant, I believe. Is that right? I could be wrong. I don't have my notes in front of me because I'm an idiot. And after being present at the liberation of Dachau, and he said he walked in and sat down, and his dad nodded to him and did not stop cutting the person's hair who he was cutting, and he said that was about it. There was no parade. There was no hug. He was home. Wow. This is Schulz himself in front of a doghouse with a dog. That dog is not Snoopy. That was his dog Spike, which he drew for a strip called Ripley's Believe It or Not, which actually all of those places that are look like tourist traps that are in Las Vegas and cities that why would anybody go to them? But it was actually a comic strip before it was a wax museum or whatever the hell it is. Yeah, I'm not sure. And Schulz drew, that was his very first published drawing, was of Spike, a dog that eats broken glass and razor blades, which I still doubt. But how can a dog eat a razor blade? Is that possible? I don't think it is. But you can see, you know, this is the man himself as a kid. And clearly these things impressed on his mind in many ways and became part of his strip. So that's him, I think, pretty much at the... Whenever I think of Charles Schulz, I think of him like this. A happy, smiling, successful guy at his drawing table, thatch of really healthy hair, which he had until he died, much to my chagrin. I don't know what... So he was like one of the few cartoonists to keep it, I think. And you can see here that it has a definite physiological effect on your porpoise. I visited this studio at the invitation, actually, of Chip when he did his first book, within months of Schultz's death, actually. Everything was still as it was. There were actually unfinished strips next to his drawing table, just some panels with no drawing in them, just some scribbles of text. And behind him on that wall there, there's like wood paneling. There was a mark where he just had leaned back for decades and slid his chair, and it was just worn into the wall, as well as a spot on the table itself from him leaning on it and drawing 17,897 comic strips, wow, which is the grand total. And in case anybody is interested, the music on his record player was Brahms's piano quartet in G minor number 25, which is a beautiful piece of music. Brahms was his favorite composer. This is kind of inappropriate to show at the top of the program, but I'll do it unless you want to start asking questions and we can come back to this, because I have three slides that show weird moments in Peanuts that not many people know about, that are kind of, it's sort of like smoking pot and reading Peanuts or something. It's really kind of a weird experience, but I can talk about
them. What would you prefer?
You're the moderator. You moderate away. So.
Okay, well, so why don't we mix it up a little bit and return to the specific images. Sounds
okay.
Good?
So the AV man can douse the screen, or you want to leave it up?
Should we leave it up?
Yeah. Just leave it up.
Okay, we'll just let people look at it for while we talk if you want.
Okay, so here's my opening question. I don't think we should do something where we go down the line, because that is always a conversation stultifier. But I do want to...
Oh.
Sorry. You can't hear me now. I'll speak really loudly. Okay, so... what I wanted to ask you was, if each of you could say, necessarily no, right? I mean, in some ways, even people who don't know what the strip is about know Snoopy, for example, right? You know, so there's the whole question of merchandise. Peanuts is a strip about X and Y. What would you say? Mm. Or just X. One word, one sentence. How would you sum it up?
Well, if I wanted to be snarky, I would say it's a strip about nothing.
Huh. Okay.
Like Seinfeld or something?
Yeah.
I would say it's a strip about everything.
Well, all right.
Yeah.
So Chip says it's a strip about nothing. Chris says it's a strip about everything. What about you guys?
I'd say it's a strip about the basic quality of life, which is experienced by children. The basic quality of your whole life, you know, the adversity you face, the little moments of joy, somehow all experienced by people who never grow older.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Andrew?
Well, I was going to say life and love and loss, and love is almost exclusively unrequited.
Right, yeah.
I'll revise my answer. I'm going to steal from you, because your last word in your very fine essay in the book is compassion. Hmm. And I think that might be what this strip is ultimately about. So,
Can I just add one thing?
Please.
I think it was the writer George Saunders who said he likes to consider, and it's so interesting that the Peanut strip ran uninterrupted and covers the entire second half of the 20th
century.
It's
an amazing time.
Starts in 1950, ends in 2000. Yeah. And if you really look at it as arguably the world's longest novel, it starts to become this. So if you consider it that way, it's really kind of fascinating.
Well, and you think he was the most read author on planet Earth. As well. I think at one point he had 70 million readers. I think the only other thing would be God in the Bible.
Okay.
God wrote the Bible.
So the follow-up question, I mean, just for those of you who don't know, it was a slide earlier, but so the full title is, of the volume, The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang, and the Meaning of Life. Hmm. Okay, so we had phrases up here like nothing, everything, love, life, loss. Can people sort of follow up about the philosophy of Peanuts? Mm.
You're never going to really get what you want, but you have to keep trying.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Schultz was by far the most successful cartoonist in the history of the medium, yet he always felt like he wasn't. There was always something that he could pull out that proved to him that he was not successful, or that he hadn't done what he wanted to do, or that, you know, the large, if he looked at the, you know, the financial remuneration that he was receiving, that wasn't enough because he felt like he was just a cartoonist. He wasn't an artist.
Did it feel like false modesty to you ever? Because it took a little time for me to actually become convinced that it was quite real, even when he would invoke, "Well, I'm not Andrew Wyeth," sort of a common refrain, right?
It's weird modesty. Mm. I don't think it's false. I think he just had this like program running in his brain called Mom 1.0 or something that just didn't allow him to take a compliment and didn't allow him to take himself too seriously. It's like a Midwestern thing.
Chris, do you see that reflected in the strip? Is it sort of like the football that never gets kicked?
Well, I think there's an innate humility to this strip, not only in the narrative and the characters, but in the line itself. You look, you feel the line, you feel the hand of Charles Schulz when you read that strip. When you're looking at those characters moving around on the page, you're feeling Schulz's hand moving around on the page. It's really a very strange thing that he did to have millions of readers feeling through his hand and through his, going through the hand up and down, up through the eyes and back down into your heart from his or something. It's a strange sort of, you know, connection. So
I was just going to say about, that's an interesting question about the meaning of Peanuts, but the first thing that comes to mind is the importance in life of taking pleasure in your own desires and aspirations, because there is so little fulfillment in Peanuts. You know, if you're an aspiring whatever, you have to take joy in the fact that you are trying to do this thing, that you want to accomplish this thing, even if you don't, ultimately.
Including Snoopy as a writer, right?
Mm.
I mean, Ann Patchett has a piece in the book, and she attributes her career, that she says she wouldn't have become a writer had it not been for sort of modeling Snoopy, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Andrew, maybe we could stick with you for a moment. As the editor, you know, we were mentioning before that to be publishing from 1950 to 2000 is this amazing sort of chunk of time, you know, the second half of the century. You know, you were talking about your personal passion for Peanuts, but if we could look at it more from a sort of longer view, wider view, why this volume now?
Hmm. That's the question I asked myself, because these books are heavy lifts, and we were talking before the program started about, you know, there's almost a guilt involved, whether you're writers or editors, that it's supposed to be drudgery and you're not allowed to have any fun or enjoy it. I had read David Michaelis's biography, I think, three times. I'd read a lot about Peanuts. The word anthology, I think, comes from the Latin for loosely translated bouquet. Mm. So why now? You know, if I had more, it looks convenient that it's the 70-year anniversary coming up next year, and so there'll be some things to commemorate that, and it's 20 years since Schulz died as of next year, but I never really am hip to sort of timing things. It was just kind of organic. I had finished with the Beatles, and I wasn't even casting about for the next thing, but I just thought that there was something to be said, and I wanted more than one voice to say it. I mean, I could have tried to commission any of these people to write. I'd read entire books by some of these guys on Peanuts alone, but I thought the diversity of voices and perspectives and experiences across the spectrum is sort of what made it worth doing.
And I'm really struck, too, that it's published by the Library of America, which is a publisher that I've respected for so long, and is really a publisher of, the classics, and hasn't done a lot of visually oriented stuff. So the Library of America a couple years ago published the complete works, but a collection of work by Lynd Ward, who was a graphic artist publishing in the 1920s and 30s. But they haven't been too oriented toward cartoonists, for example. So it seems like a big deal that this is a Library of America book.
It was a big deal to me. It was a surprise in the best possible taste. They also don't generally do work that's original commissioned for the book. They do archival reprint, which is perfectly valuable and great. So they took a little bit of a chance and made a little bit of a leap. And three of the pieces, including Chris's, have already been excerpted by the New Yorker. So, and the book hasn't even come out yet till Tuesday. And you know, I think November 1st, there's a Peanuts on Apple TV. There's a Peanuts program that's launching. I think come January. Come January, there's a new national tour of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And I was flummoxed to read the statistic that You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown is the most produced show, I think what I read, in American theater history. And the number, I don't know how they quantify this, because a lot of them are junior high school productions, but it's 40,000 productions.
Wow.
That have encompassed 250,000 people who have just been in that show at some point in their lives.
Okay, so maybe I'm just asking the same question a different way, and if I am, just tell me. But how would you account, I think of you all as Peanuts experts, for the persistent, enormous, ongoing popularity of Peanuts, you know, along the lines you were just describing?
There's something there for everybody. there really is. I was struck reading the book that a couple of people referred to made a comparison between Snoopy and Fonzie, because in Happy Days, you know, the show started off being about Ricky, and then Fonzie.
Somehow, this is a problem happening to all of us.
Back of the microphone. Jesus Christ! I hate these goddamn.
Here, we'll pass. Right? Okay.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah. I'm using the Lord's name in vain. Did it stop working? Okay. Fuck it.
Do you want to keep talking?
So Happy Days started off being about Richie, and then Fonzie got really popular. And then Peanuts, of course, the central character is Charlie Brown, but some people, a lot of people like Snoopy better. But the comparison is limited because with Happy Days, there's Richie and Fonzie, and there's pretty much everybody else. Nobody is really stands out. But there's so many colorful characters in Peanuts. You may not like Charlie Brown, but you love Snoopy, or you may not, you know, you may think you may not be into Snoopy, but you feel like Linus is like just a model human being. So I feel like some people in the book don't like Linus especially. Some people think he's the greatest character. So there's like such a variety of things to hold on to.
Yeah, and maybe this is a question that will lead into style, but it seems connected to the amount of information. Like, there's just the right amount of information about characters, but the reader is imagining a lot, too. And I was struck in Chip's presentation when he talked about minimalism. And I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about Schultz's style. Chris started talking about it just a few moments ago.
Before he started cursing.
You know, what kinds of information are we being given about this world of Peanuts? Through the line, through the mark.
Well, the mark certainly evolves over time, but and he, as he was working on the strip, he always did the strip. When I said he had an assistant, he did, but for other things, he did every strip by himself for 20 years. He made sure that he was the only person, he wanted total control over it. And it does evolve, and by the 60s, the backgrounds become very, very flat. Like when they're at that wall, and they're, you know, I think in his mind, and correct me if I'm wrong, like it was the words that mattered more and the emotions that mattered more. It didn't really matter if he could draw a street scene convincingly. That wasn't what it was about anymore. It was about, you know, philosophy, loneliness, you know, how do you deal with your sadness? But a lot of it was absolutely hysterical. It was very funny.
But doesn't the success of what you were just talking about hinge on the style?
Oh, totally. Yes. It's just that the style changed, and the style became, you know, something very recognizable. And Chris and I were talking about this the other night. Like most of the people in this room tried to draw Charlie Brown into the margin of their social studies textbook because they were bored. And every time you tried to do it, it just didn't look right. It's very, very hard to try and replicate. And like, why? It's just seven little squiggles.
But why is it?
Because nobody could do it like him.
Is this, it's really literally the transmutation of his soul into a little ideogram on the page. I'm really sorry for cursing. Really bad.
It's a given that tech problems will happen. What do other people think about the style? I mean, it's so characteristic. Like, the two things I think about when I think about Peanuts are philosophy and that style.
Yeah. Well, it's born of the limitations of the strip. The strip was sold to papers as a space-saving strip. It was designed so that it could be run as a horizontal, as a vertical, or as a little box. And it took up two-thirds of the space of a regular strip. And Schultz was especially galled by that. It was his, you know, but he couldn't say no because it was his one shot. And he was especially galled by the title, which he did not come up with. It was the salesman at the syndicate who came up with it. He felt it was demeaning and belittling, ironically. And he had to design the strip so that the characters were legible. And as he worked on the strip and worked within its limitations, he managed to kind of codify it, and it started to become something very strange and allow these things to come out within him that otherwise might not have been if he was drawing something that you might think of as like a hole in the page, as like a camera or something. This was a hole into his heart. It wasn't a camera looking out at the world. So actually, I could show that one image now if you want, if the AV guy will still talk to me after I cursed into his microphone. So
yeah, perfect.
He's left. He's gone. He's not going to do anything. Okay, maybe we should not.
You can't advance the slide?
I can't, no. It's just that. He gave up. He had a... Can you go to the... Never mind. This is not working.
Yep. I'm
sorry.
Anyway,
oh, there we go. Okay.
Go back.
Sorry. I'm not sure how we go backwards. So I'll just talk through this real quickly. This is an experiment that Schultz did in 1954 as a Sunday page where, for some reason, he thought it would be a good idea for Lucy and Charlie Brown to participate in a golf tournament. And, I mean, aside from the total weirdness of that, if you look there, you can see adults in the strip. They're in that long panel there. They're following up Charlie Brown and Lucy, who look like little teeny tiny like hobbits or something. And then they're in the background there where Lucy is saying, I'm supposed to be home taking a nap. And the whole effect is extremely disquieting and very, very strange. Because what it does is it provides an adult comparison point for the kids and turns them back into kids. It makes them feel like real kids. And in the essay, it feels like the strip has the flu or something, or like it's like he has a fever drawing it. So he did not do this again. This was a one-time experiment, but he did do this.
And for those of you who don't know, it was very rare, correct me if I'm wrong, for there to be adults in Peanuts.
There were
right?
never adults
in Peanuts. Right. Except where the strip got the flu.
There were actually three of those golf strips. Right. He did it for 3 weeks, and then that was it.
That was it. It was him basically figuring out that adults were always off-site. They were there, but you never saw them. The strip was literally from the inside of a kid's mind, basically. But he did this even freakier, weirder experiment, I think in 1955. It's a strip that he titled up at the top, Hagemeyer. But he did it on the Peanuts empty. These are pre-printed four panels that the syndicate set up for him with the Peanuts logo in it. And this is a strip with adults. And it's a strip about guys working in a stock room with an angry woman as their boss. And I mean, every time I look at this, I would have paid a lot of money for this in high school, like to take psychedelics or something and just look. It's like reading Peanuts if the characters age. It's like Lucy became a stock clerk or something like that. But it's actually named after a very good friend of Schultz's whom he was... in the army with named Elmer Hagemeyer. Hagemeyer became kind of like an older brother to Schultz in a way. So it's sort of a tribute to him. But this never appeared anywhere. This was only just one time. This is kind of funny. I'm just showing this real quick here. There's a character that Schultz introduced named Charlotte Brown, who's kind of a mean-spirited girl. And this is, Schultz is a very nice man, but it's clear that he kind of had it at a certain point, and he'd gotten a letter from somebody saying they did not like the character, so he wrote them back and said, okay, I will take the character out, but you will have to have the death of an innocent child on your hands. And then he drew a picture of the character with an axe.
Axe in the head.
Anyway, okay.
Wow. So maybe this connects. I was struck by compassion being the last word of your essay, and it's also something that other people wrote about in their essays, and you know, this is something that I write about in my book, even before you wrote about it yourself in this essay, how you sent a Valentine to Charlie Brown when you were a kid.
I did, yeah.
Can you tell us about that? Is that a story about compassion?
I mean, Chip told me that there were thousands of kids who did that, and he even showed one of the letters.
Yes, the first letter I showed was letters that he would send back to kids who sent him Valentines, because they would get thousands of them every year.
And what Clifford said in his essay, too, is that, you get right to the point where you say these characters were your friends. And I felt exactly the same way when I was a kid reading those books. I felt like I was with my friends when I was reading them, and that's why you send a cartoon character a Valentine.
Yeah. And Chris, didn't you say Schultz is the only writer you've been reading your whole life?
Yeah. I mean, I can't think of anybody else. Yeah, and I get something out of it every time now. It's not like I go back to reading, childhood books or something. You read Schultz. You kind of have to remember, the strip was not intended for children. It was intended for adults. The comics page was for adults, and its initial readers were educated college students. He was really, like, hip. If you look at pictures of him signing books in the 1950s, he's just surrounded by like 18, 19-year-old guys in horn-rimmed glasses looking really excited to meet him. So it's only in time that's gone on since then we've come to think of it as a kid strip, but it's not a kid strip at all. It's a strip with kids.
Right.
And the history of comics is basically adults acting like children until World War II, and apparently us, I guess, doing horrible things in the world, and then strips change, and it turns into kids acting like adults, with Peanuts being the first example. So.
Well, we were somewhere the other day, I think it was the New Yorker Festival maybe, and the question came up of, is Peanuts dark? And this question of dark, dark, dark. And I think you were the one who sort of stemmed the tide of the momentum of that conversation. You sort of flipped the word from dark to that it was real.
Yeah.
And that was part of what made it distinctive, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we'd all agree that probably reading it as kids, you felt like, oh, this feels like he's telling us the truth.
But what is that quality of realness? Like, how would we characterize it?
Well, Charlie Brown's depressed. He's lonely. And the one thing that used to sort of throw me is that, okay, one week he and Lucy are getting along, and they seem like they are really friends, and then the next week she just turns on him. And that would happen, you know. And like, who didn't experience things like that as a kid? Like, wait a minute, I thought you were my friend.
Right.
It's like, how could you do that now? And it's like, whoa.
And then in response to that, did he go see her as a psychiatrist?
As a psychiatrist.
Double dipped? Like, I mean, she's just like...
completely crazy.
Very self-serving.
Completely crazy.
It's also, I mean, I think you're right. It's not a strip for kids, but in a way it uses kids and some of the qualities of children. And I don't think this is a mean thing to say. I think it's true. Kids are the meanest people on earth. You know, they really are. They just say horrible things to each other and do horrible things to each other. And you know, and this sort of prefigures what you're going to encounter at some point in your life. But it really starts there. You know, so he's at once using that quality of children and childhood to kind of forecast the eventualities in your life.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. On that somewhat sad note, let's open it up for questions. We have about 15 minutes for questions from the audience. And I see someone coming up right now. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi. Let's turn this up. My name is Matt.
Hi, Matt.
So from my recollection, other than the examples that you just showed, there's never ever anything in Peanuts that is from the outside world. In other words, you don't have any examples or references to specific things happening in the world, in society, in history, the wars or whatever. Do you know of any? I mean, so it would seem like any strip could have happened at any day in that 50-year period of time. Is that true according to the way you understand it?
Not always.
No.
Not always.
No. He responded to. He never saw the strip as political, but there were certain things that he would do in response to things that were going on in the world. Right. Yeah.
Did they specifically mention them, or just
It's a function of editing, basically. Like, a lot of those strips were taken out of the reprint books because they had a shelf life of an avocado. But he kept in the ones that were more about this.
There was at least one reference to Hyannis, right? Hyannis Port. I don't know if that was during Kennedy administration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
There was a reference to prayer in schools.
Oh my God! Yeah. Yes, that was that's very famous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very famous. We prayed in school today.
Right.
Right.
Thank you for that question. Other questions?
It's the only one. Please come forth.
Thank you.
They're gonna fight it out.
Speaking of the timeliness and the scale differences of adults, I was wondering if anyone on the panel had ever read Schultz's strip Teenager.
Yes.
And which was very much, I felt like, a reaction to the creation of the term and also the spirit of the time in which it was set.
Mm-hmm. Well, I went into that with the Only What's Necessary book, and for a good long time, Schultz was a very religious man, and he did a series of, I think, one-panel gags featuring teenagers, but they all had a religious theme to them. And was it called Teenagers? I guess
there's one called What Was Bugging Old Pharaoh, and he did another panel cartoon called It's Only a Game.
Yes, he was obsessed with bridge.
Yeah. That didn't last so long. Actually, he didn't draw it after the first couple of years. It was his assistant and friend from Art Instruction Incorporated who drew it. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
I like what you said about, it wasn't dark, it was real, because there was sort of a realism to Peanuts, both when you read it as a child and when you read it as an adult. And I used to think, why is it that this seems sort of sad and yet it doesn't make me feel bad, as a kid? And the closest comparison I could think of in writers of prose was probably Kurt Vonnegut, where he tended to have the darkness of reality, and yet his books are sort of uplifting somehow. I wondered if there were any other authors of prose that you might compare to Schultz in terms of their effect.
Thank you. Really interesting question.
That's a really good question.
Yeah. Well, I would say any writer who creates characters that you care about and you can feel through, because that was Charles Schultz's great innovation in the comic strip, was to create an empathetic character in Charlie Brown. You felt for him and you felt sorry for him, but you also felt through him. I mean, that's really the great accomplishment of him, and it's not... You feel sorry for... I mean, art can either divert, like just kind of make you forget about your problems, or it can give you something to feel through your problems with, and Peanuts did both. And it's kind of hard to balance those two things, but you can't really think of any other comic strip that ever did that had characters in it that you could care about and feel through. So, it kind of unnerves me that I hear that some people, when they read it now, especially younger people... I was talking to Michael Sheban the other night at the New Yorker Festival, and he said that he tried to get his son to read Peanuts, and his son said, "I don't want to read it. It's just sad, and it makes me sad, and it makes me sad that you liked it because it was sad and all the sad stuff you like." And he was like...
That's so pretty much
what was your daughter?
Yeah.
Same way?
Yeah. She said, the difference between me and my daughter was that she was much more just kind of socially adept than I was as a kid, so... Part of the appeal of Charlie Brown for me was that, wow, here's this other kid who is shy and just doesn't always know what to do and feels depressed sometimes, and he's like me, he's my friend, and so my daughter, my daughter, I remember she said that he is depressed and depressing, and
same
so
thing,
she yeah. really just had no had no use for him. So, yeah, she was a Garfield fan.
Right, and you're so funny about this in the essay, right? Garfield, who his main shtick is that he's entitled
right.
to more lasagna, yeah. more naps, right? So sort of like the opposite of Charlie Brown.
Right. He just gets everything he wants through you know, his sense of entitlement.
Yeah. But what about this interesting part of the question that was about a prose analog? Does anybody have something in mind?
Actually, I just read Man in the Ceiling by Jules Feiffer, which is... I think it was a little something to Charlie Brown. Yeah, it's. I guess it's a YA book, but I think it's really good.
Well, it would embarrass Schultz to say this, but I would say Tolstoy and Flaubert, any writer who created a character who you cared about and moved you, you know, he was doing that, and he had lots of readers who felt that and were compelled to write him, and we're here sitting talking about him because of that. So. And it may not be the exact same sort of thing, where those books are about the details of life and how people live their lives, but he caught something even more weirdly abstract and heartfelt in these little teeny tiny ideograms, I think. So you think of the authors that he really loved, you know. So he did love Tolstoy. So
and we mentioned Salinger. I mean, that short story for Esme with Love and Squalor. Mm-hmm. I mean, woof.
Yeah.
You know, you read that, you know, I don't know, in junior high, and you get one thing out of it, and then you read it as an adult, and you get something very different out of it. And kids play, well, she's a kid, and she plays a very significant role in that story.
Interesting, yeah. Yes, thank you.
Hi. My question is about Snoopy. So I always loved Charlie Brown growing up and read them, watched the shows, and my husband and I have been exposing our 5-year-old to Charlie Brown's Good. We haven't read it with him yet, but we watch all of the movies and shows. And I didn't realize until I was an adult, like, what a jerk Snoopy is to Charlie Brown. And dogs are supposed to be really loyal to their people, and I'm wondering if you all have any thoughts about why Snoopy is not always loyal to Charlie Brown. No, because it's watching it with my 5-year-old, it's like we have to explain, like, Snoopy's kind of mean sometimes.
Who
So, just wondering your thoughts on that.
No, that's a really good point.
Who wrote the essay in the book that said, in the Charlie Brown-Snoopy relationship, Charlie Brown is the dog? You know,
he's one of them. That's
Sarah Boxer. Sarah Boxer. Yeah. A lot about Snoopy's narcissism.
Yeah.
And I don't know who was it first said, maybe Chip would know, that getting Snoopy up on his hind legs, of course, was a pivotal and maybe controversial point, because that's when the strip really changed. Is that right?
And that's when Snoopy really changed. Snoopy walked on all fours till around, what, the mid-60s. So a good 15 years. And then somehow Schultz had, whether he was bored or whatever, it's like, wait a minute, let's have him stand up. And then when that happened, he kind of didn't become a dog anymore. He became the Red Baron, or, you know, that was his first real persona outside of just being a dog. But I think that also had to do more with, like I was saying, the unpredictability of life and friendship and relatives, and, you know, sometimes you're getting along and sometimes you're not.
Right.
But I mean, I have a almost five-year-old at home who should be going to sleep soon on a Snoopy pillow case. And it's his favorite character, and I just on a very simple level, ascribe it to the mischievousness of Snoopy and the fun-loving aspect of it. I'm just reminded it's sort of a non sequitur, but I think one of you guys could probably tell me that I think Schultz got a lot of letters or communications asking, why can't you let Charlie Brown just kick the football once? Why does Lucy always have... And I do know that Schultz was on record then saying, because it wouldn't be funny the way she pulls it away. And he had to come up with different ways of having her trick him for, I think that gag ran for, what, 40 years maybe?
Yeah, yeah.
Snoopy's kind of the id of the strip.
I think he's the only character in the strip who, it's hinted, was involved in a sexual relationship.
So can you elaborate?
Girlfriend. Well, I don't want to elaborate, but I mean, it's like interesting territory that it was suggested there. But didn't he have a girlfriend, and, like, you know, he hate to forget and stuff. That's about as close as you're going to get, maybe aside from Linus being floating in the air because he loves Miss Othmar so much. But
Snoopy, do you write about Snoopy, how he kisses? He's the only one who really
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, it's like Me Too by Spear, you know, like he's going around kissing all the girls and everything. So, what do you think of that? Wow, there's a ripe for...
You thought of it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so you're our last question.
Oh, well, it's not even a question, but my wife, who wears her Lucy Van Pelt T-shirt with pride, made a funny comment that you might appreciate, that it... added a lot to the panel that you were having trouble with the microphones, because I suddenly was seeing everyone as a Charles Schulz cartoon with like a line going up and going, ah! Yes. So nobody feel bad about problems with the mics, because it actually made it much better. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're very kind.
Fortunately, the word I used was not ugh.
Thank you for your generosity. Okay, let's have a round of applause for our panelists.
Okay. Thank you.